You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this cloudy Monday afternoon. The line between life and death, to many of us, seems to be firmly drawn, although it is always terribly painful and full of sadness when it involves someone we love. When the heart stops beating and cannot be restarted, or when brain activity ceases, most doctors consider a patient to have died. But Dr. Sanjay Gupta is fascinated with stories about patients who seemingly came back from death, and his new book, Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds, is a medical thriller that explores new life-saving and life-reviving medical interventions. Dr. Gupta's new book is published by Grand Central Press, and a companion documentary to his book will air on CNN this weekend. The documentary is called Another Day, Cheating Death. Dr. Gupta, welcome to the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks, Julie. Great to be here.
In the introduction of the book, you write, in order to cheat death, we have to first better understand it. What is it that you think most people don't understand about death?
Well, I think as you said, and even for me, most medical professionals, there is sort of this big, white, bright line drawn between life and death. You're here and then you're not. And I remember when I was a medical student, the first time I saw someone die, you know, I'd never seen it. I was in my early 20s, and the person who died was around my age. And I remember everyone working on this person after a car accident and trying to bring the person to life or to keep them from dying. Then at some point, someone just looked at the clock and said, okay, that's it. And I remember thinking to myself, even at that moment, that's it? I mean, that's how this works? It had such an arbitrary nature to it. And I think that's sort of the first point, is that there is a lot that's going on during the process of death. There are all these death pathways, for example, in the body that are activated, and they start this cascade of events in the body that, you know, uses oxygen and produces all these free radicals and causes cells to die. But it doesn't happen instantaneously, and it doesn't even happen in a short amount of time. It takes a long time. And as we understand all those various steps, all the various, you know, scientific steps in the cascade, at any point in there, you can either stop it or try and reverse it. That's what I found so fascinating. And a lot of it was just about buying more time, slowing everything down a little bit.
And perhaps that's why many of the people you write about are people who suffered sudden issues, whether it was drowning or heart attacks or strokes or things like that. I mean, I just sadly myself have experienced a death of my father-in-law who had Parkinson's and pneumonia, and their death was a very different process in that it was something we knew was going to happen, but over a very long period of time. But here you're writing about people who suffer these instantaneous moments of something happening. And then can you talk a little bit about the medical student in Norway who had an experience that most of us would call death?
Yeah, I found her very fascinating, and she has the dubious honor of being the coldest ever living human being to still be alive. She was, you know, around 56 degrees Fahrenheit, so very cold. She was a skier, a medical student, as you mentioned. She lost control one day, and her head ended up going through a frozen stream. And so she was freezing and drowning sort of at the same time, and it was a sudden event, as you mentioned. What was so striking about her story is that she was for about an hour underneath this, you know, this water, and she struggled for a little bit and then stopped struggling. Her friends were desperately trying to get her out. They finally did get her out, tried CPR, but nothing sort of worked for her. It was a couple more hours by the time they transported her to the hospital and all this. It was an incredibly long time. Just to give you a frame of reference, 10 minutes or so without a heartbeat. And in a hospital, most doctors will say, you know, this isn't, you know, it's over. 3 hours, this woman had been without a heartbeat, without any spontaneous respirations. Her pupils were dilated, which indicates that the brain had become swollen, all of that. And the doctors in Norway, where this happened, decided to keep her cold.
Well, there's a saying, and I've heard it before, and you write about it, that you're not dead until you're warm and dead.
That's right. You're not dead until you're warm and dead. And it's a fascinating thing, and it conjures up all these ideas that, what is happening when you're cold? I mean, you're still not beating your heart. You're still not, you know, breathing on your own. And the reality is that we as human beings have the capacity to hibernate. We actually carry the genes for hibernation, which I found so fascinating. And could cold be one of those stimuli for hibernation? What seems to be exactly the case? In this, Anna Bagenholm is the name of the skier, this young woman. She was likely hibernating, which looks dead, but as they slowly started to rewarm her, recognizing that cold can be beneficial here, They warmed her slowly. She slowly started to get things back. And, you know, I'll cut to the chase a little bit. I just got back from Norway where I spent a lot of time with her. But she is now a physician in the exact same hospital where she was once declared dead. And I point that out only to say that not only is she alive, she's fully functional. Her brain works normally. I spent, you know, days with her just talking. She was dead. And the reality is that warm and dead or whatever, 3 hours without a heartbeat, most hospitals, most places in the world would have said she has no chance.
What I found fascinating about this story, in addition, was that the doctor who revived her had tried to do this with other people and failed. What was the difference?
There was a lot that went into the saving of Anna Bagenholm. It's too easy to say simply they kept her cold and that was it. There's a lot of things that happen in the body. For example, Dr. Gilbert, who you're talking about, had been studying this for a long time, and hypothermia as a therapy had been studied for a few decades. But your body starts to react to the cold. For example, your blood vessels become very leaky. They want to leak some of the fluid into your lungs and into your brain. Your blood, your platelets don't work as well, so you're more likely to bleed, for example. So what he realized is that he had to avoid giving too much fluid, otherwise she would essentially crush her brain within her skull and overload her lungs. So he essentially gave her no fluids during the entire time she was being resuscitated.
Which goes against regular practice, I would guess.
The first thing almost any paramedic will do in the field, anybody certainly when they get to the emergency room, is start IVs and start pumping in fluid. And this was absolutely the opposite of that. And, you know, it was a risky move at the time. Now we can say, wow, it worked. But at the time, it was a risky thing. He also kept her cold for a lot longer. Again, sort of really walking this fine line between using the benefits of hypothermia with some of the potential catastrophes.
When he was doing this in the moment, I know you weren't there, but I would guess that these things are easier to take risks on when you have a patient who is as dead as Anna Bagenholm was than it would be saying someone who might make it and can you take these risks?
It's a great point, and Anna Bagenholm makes that point clearly. But I think the issue you're raising here, I think, transcends many things in medicine. Vioxx, for example, when it was approved and then subsequently taken off the market, the reason that was so problematic, I think, for people was that, you know, you're essentially treating – some people have terrible debilitating arthritis, but a lot of people were taking it for a tennis elbow or some sort of knee pain and then come to find out you can have these terrible heart-related side effects. When you're talking about patients who have no other alternatives – sudden cardiac arrest, if nothing is done, you have a 3% chance of survival. Glioblastoma is the most malignant tumor the human body has ever seen. People don't survive that. Anna Bagenholm was frozen cold for 3 hours. No one survives that. So you're right. These are opportunities for doctors and other healthcare professionals to take leaps. And I personally believe, after working on this book now for as long as I'm a slow writer, but as long as I've been working on this book.
We have a few other things that you do. So,
well, I tend to think a lot. You know, it's funny when I'm sitting around walking around the house and I tell my wife, okay, I'm going to go write for a while, but then I'm kind of wandering around the house. She said, I thought you were writing. And I said, well, this is part of the writing. I'm sort of ruminating on things. But you're right. You can take more of a chance with patients who don't have any other options. And I think, to take that a step further, is that some of the biggest sea changes in medicine occur during those leaps.
Cold is something you write about in a couple of cases in this book. And one of the things that I found interesting was in a an emergency room or a hospital dealing with things that happen all the time, like heart attacks, the idea of cold is still very controversial.
It is. And I don't get it. You know, and I visited hospitals all over the country really asking about this. So we're in New York right now, and you know, in some ways, you're very fortunate to be living in New York, because if you were to have a sudden cardiac arrest, the paramedics that would show up would probably show up with their medicine bags, with defibrillators, and with an ice chest. And they would literally start putting ice-cold saline into your veins, start cooling you in the field, so to speak. And then when you get to the hospital, they keep doing it. I come from a very small town in Michigan. That's where my family lives. We have heart disease in our family. They probably wouldn't do that there because it just hasn't caught on. The thing that sort of is interesting to me is we're not talking about a $1 billion drug, a fancy new procedure or treatment. We're talking about ice. It's almost free, and it exponentially can improve someone's survival from a cardiac arrest. I don't know why we don't do it. Maybe it's because it's not a $1 billion drug. It doesn't have the champion or the advocate or someone screaming from the rooftops to do this. It should be done, in my opinion.
I'm speaking to Dr. Sanjay Gupta. He has written a book called Cheating Death. That's from Grand Central Press. You touch on this a couple of times in the book, and I found it fascinating, exactly the point you've just raised, in that many of the interventions you're writing about, whether it's using ice to chill someone who's had a heart attack, or a different form of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. They don't have big pharmaceutical companies behind them. So how do we, as patients and also your fellow doctors, how do we learn about these things that may not help somebody's bottom line?
Well, it's a great question, and something that I researched quite a bit, you know, over the last couple of years. I don't know if there's a great answer to that, but I will say this. I think some of it is just what we're doing right now, you know, simply talking like we are now. I think that does make a difference. And I will say, you know, it was never my intention to malign or indict the way that things are done in the medical profession. I mean, there is some rationale for moving slowly when it comes to some decisions and approvals and recommended therapies. I mean, the American Heart Association redoes their guidelines every 5 years. So right now, chest compression only, for example, resuscitation is a part of their approved therapies, but not the recommended ones. It probably will change. Should it change faster? I personally think so, because I think, you know, with the right amount of time, I could empower anybody to be able to resuscitate someone from a cardiac arrest and do it more effectively than how they would probably do it right now. But, you know, it's sort of just a slow moving elephant, and it has its benefits and its disadvantages as well.
I'd like to talk with you about that new kind of CPR. I remember learning CPR when my kids were little and learning how to do the compressions and then the rescue breathing. Tell us about this shift that you encountered.
Well, I think the background on it is so fascinating. The idea is this, that you know, most people have heard of CPR. If you see someone walking down the street today, for you here, Julian, the streets of New York, you see someone collapse, would you know exactly what to do? And what most people will say is, well, I generally know. You know, I took a class a while ago. I sort of know. And if you ask most people, would they help? They'll say, sure, I'd help. But the reality is very few people do. Bystander help is exceedingly hard to come by. And we know if somebody nobody helps, the survival rate's around 2 or 3%. It's
terrible. Because help immediately is an essential piece of recovery.
Correct. It really makes all the difference in a sudden cardiac arrest. Now, if you ask people, why don't they help? I mean, they could have helped. Why are you just standing around? A lot of it is a sort of awkwardness or discomfort with the mouth-to-mouth component of resuscitation. They don't quite know how to do it, or they feel awkward about putting their mouth to someone else's mouth who is dying, whatever it might be. So what these researchers in Arizona said, well, what if we eliminate that part of things? What if we just do the chest compressions? And what they found early on when they're doing animal studies was that not only was it as good as doing conventional CPR with mouth-to-mouth, it was actually better. And they started to try and figure out, why is that? Why would that be better? And they realized that if you have a sudden cardiac arrest and you were just breathing literally the moment before, you actually have plenty of oxygen in your blood, maybe up to 10 minutes worth of oxygen in your blood. The key, more than anything else, is to move that oxygenated blood through the body.
Which is what the heart does.
So mm-hmm. Think of your hands pushing in the middle of someone's chest, right between their nipples, as hard as you can, as fast as you can, 100 times a minute. As almost like an artificial heart. Call 911 so the paramedics are on their way, and then just start doing this. Do it hard enough that within a minute or so you're breaking a sweat. A proper resuscitation has people who have broken ribs, because you're actually putting in a significant thrust on the rib cage. But it is an amazingly powerful thing, and anybody can do this. And by the way, if you do this, the chance of survival in Arizona, where this started, can go almost 1,000%.
Whoa.
Improvement in survival. And again, we're talking about your two hands, nothing else.
What's that rhythm like? As I was thinking about this, I was thinking, I know what 60 seconds are like, but what's 100? I mean, if you were to kind of beat it, what would it be like for us?
Some people play music in their head. You know, paramedics who do this regularly, Staying Alive is ironically one of the songs
really?
They play in their head.
So that is
right.
Enough to get 100 beats a minute.
But you can sort of do that, and it's really about as fast as you can do it and get a good chest compression each time. So you're really pushing down and feeling the chest come back up, pushing down, feeling it come back up. So if you're doing it adequately, as fast as you can, you'll probably hit about 100 beats a minute.
One of the things that you look at throughout this book is what we've talked about at the beginning, that sort of line between what is life and what is death. And one of the most fascinating people you talked to was a researcher who was looking at hibernation, at ways of taking animals into what we would call death and then bringing them back. Sort of suspended animation, which is something, you know, I know happens on the science fiction programs that my sons watch, but it seemed from reading this like this is something people are seriously exploring.
They are. And I when I first started thinking about this, I thought, oh, people are going to look at this and they're going to say, hey, that sounds like science fiction, you know? And it is in many ways, but it's also happening. I mean, many of the things I write about, Julie, in this book, I couldn't have written about 10 years ago. And this is certainly one of them. Here's the basic concept is that there are ways to basically stop all metabolic processes in the body, stop all respirations, all functions of the heart, all metabolism, so your body is neither producing anything nor demanding anything. You're in a complete state of suspended animation. And what's so fascinating about this is that oxygen is a relative newcomer to living beings' existence on this planet. You know, they used to get by on hydrogen sulfide alone. Oxygen wasn't around. We didn't always need oxygen. And what we find right now is we're all breathing in 21% oxygen. That's what this air is. If I took it down to 2%, we'd probably die. But if I took it down to 0.000002%, we might not necessarily die because we need oxygen to breathe. But also oxygen is an essential ingredient for those death pathways. If you don't have it, you don't necessarily die. Now, what happens if you don't have oxygen, your cells get no fuel. So that can be a problem. So what suspended animation is all about is blocking all oxygen and providing a fuel at the same time. Give your cells, which, you know, throughout our existence on this earth have often gotten by without oxygen, give them another fuel source and stop all oxygen. And essentially you can suspend someone or suspend an animal, which they've done so far, but they're starting trials on primates and then humans.
And where, you know, I'm thinking back to my father-in-law who had pneumonia, and really what was the initial pathway to death for him was oxygen starvation, that his oxygen levels went down to 85%, and
right.
They need to be more close, I guess, to 99%. It's hard to imagine in the case of someone like my father-in-law, who was very ill to begin with, that these sorts of things would be beneficial to him. But in what situations might this one day bear fruit for people?
Well, interestingly enough, if you trace the history of where suspended animation really came from, a lot of it came from actually the Defense Department. They have a special projects organization there called DARPA, which is always looking for new ways to try and help people on a battlefield. So the scenario they painted for me when I was talking to them was, you imagine someone maybe in the hills of Afghanistan where I just was or somewhere else takes what would otherwise be a mortal wound. And, you know, the medics go rushing over to try and resuscitate and stop bleeding and do whatever and realize it's going to be a futile effort. So they take the substance, which, by the way, is called Tamiyosin. It's not available yet, but this is what they're calling it in clinical trials, and inject that straight into the thigh, you know, inject the substance.
Like epinephrine, if you're
like,
having
yeah, mm-hmm. like a shot of something. And it immediately blocks all the oxygen. So your oxygen receptors are all flooded with the substance, so you can't absorb any more oxygen. And it provides that fuel source for your cells. When you're looking at the person that's getting it, they turn gray, their lips turn blue, their eyes turn lackluster, they're not breathing, their heart's not beating, they look dead. But in fact, they're suspended. Then when you can, you take that patient, put them on a helicopter, take him to a hospital, have your whole healthcare team ready to go, poised, ready to take care of him, and boom, reanimate him and go to work. That's what they're sort of talking about when they're talking about suspended animation, how it might be used. Buying time. That's really what they're trying to do.
I'm speaking with Dr. Sanjay Gupta about his new book, Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. It's published by Wellness Central, an imprint of Hachette, and we'll be back with more after a break. Later on the show, Judy Shepard talks about her son Matthew and about what it's like to become a gay rights activist after her son was killed. And then Alicia Silverstone explains how she's made tasty foods a staple of her vegan diet. I'm Julie Burstein, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Lincoln Center, celebrating their 50th anniversary with a free exhibition on America's first performing arts center, opening Thursday at the New York Public Library for the Performing Arts. Details at lincolncenter.org/50. Movers, not shakers. Residential and commercial movers, changing the way New Yorkers feel about movers. With environmentally sustainable practices, biodiesel fuels, and reusable bins, 718-243-0221 or at moversnotshakers.com. WNYC is a media sponsor. sponsor of the Latino Heritage Festival, Fiesta Latina en el Museo, including mural making, music, and hands-on activities, Sunday, October 18th from noon until 4:30 p.m. at the Newark Museum. Details at newarkmuseum.org.
Help shorten WNYC's fundraiser by making a buyback pledge. For every $120,000 contributed by October 14th, the pledge drive will be one day shorter. We've already taken a whole day off the upcoming fundraiser thanks to our listeners. Please act now before the pledge drive begins to shorten it even more. Pledge now at WNYC.org or call 1-888-376-WNYC. And thanks.
72nd Street Express.
Hello, I'm John Ray, author of the novel Lowboy. Just about anything can happen in the New York subway.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
Maybe you got stuck in the doors once.
Ow!
Or were arrested for using the emergency exit in a non-emergency. Perhaps you met the great love of your life listening to one of the subway's many musicians. Or maybe, just maybe, you had that moment when everything wonderful about New York City just came together.
Ladies and gentlemen,
the Leonard Lopate Show wants to hear your memorable subway stories.
Because of an investigation.
Write them down in 300 words or less and send them to transitstories at WNYC.org. Submit it before October 14th. I'll read them and then announce the winners on October 23rd. More information is available on our show page at WNYC.org.
The transfer is also available to the F train by walking to the Lexington Avenue.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate today, and my guest is Dr. Sanjay Gupta, and he's written a book called Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. In your book, you write about how death is defined in different countries. What's the difference between the way we in the United States define death and the way, say, Japan might define death?
Well, you know, we have started to use what is known as brain death as sort of the ultimate criteria in the United States. And that really came about as a result of a lot of the laws surrounding transplantation of organs. You wanted the heart still to be beating so organs would still be preserved and be able to still declare someone dead. That was how that really came about. In Japan, it's much more of a cardiac death. So when the heart has stopped beating, that is really when they declare death. So someone might have brain dead long before they're actually considered dead in Japan.
You have one story here about a doctor who suffered what everyone thought was complete brain death, even brain no activity in the brainstem. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, you know, this particular patient, I think, changed the way that I think about a lot of these situations, and probably a lot of neuroscientists, the way they think about things. He had essentially a stroke. He had a period of time where his brain just went without enough oxygenated blood, as we were just talking about. And as a result, you had what many people believe was irreversible cell death in the brain. We were always taught that once the neurons in the brain die, they're not coming back. You're not getting that back. And if some of the neurons die that regulate important functions in the body, like your ability to breathe or control your heart rate, you're not going to survive. That's what everyone sort of thought had happened to him. That's what the brainstem does. And they thought his brainstem was dead, was not working. He was given hypothermic therapy, like we talked about. He was treated by a bunch of doctors who don't give up, frankly. They kept with him. He had a wife who refused to accept the 150-plus years of combined knowledge that she was getting from lots of people around her, crisp white coats, as she mentioned, to me. And these were people who basically said, you know, you should really pull the plug. There's no hope here. There's no chance. And he survived, and he is a doctor now, and he is someone who has talked about what has happened to him. He is a physical rehabilitation doctor, and one of the things that he says is that he now talks to patients even when they're in a state of what some would call persistent vegetative coma. They are in a state of what some would call brain death. He still talks to patients because he believes he could understand and heard a lot of what was going on around him when people thought he was essentially brain dead. So he survived, but he also gave us a little bit of an insight into what the mind and brain is really going through at that time. And it was quite shocking and surprising to me, but you know, he validated it all.
As a neurosurgeon yourself, though, I mean, this must be a very, very rare occurrence. So does it change the way you approach patients yourself?
I think so. It changes. Some would say what happened to him may have been a case of mistaken diagnosis. Maybe he didn't have exactly brain death. Maybe he had a trickle of blood flow still to his brain. But still, he was at a very good hospital here in New York City, and he was declared as being brain dead. So I think the point is this, that when it comes to these types of decisions, when it comes to assigning something like persistent vegetative state to somebody, inherent in the definition is a sense of permanence. If you're not 100% sure, then we probably shouldn't be using terms like that. We know that if you say someone is brain dead, or if you say they are in a persistent state of some sort, their care changes, the attitude towards that patient changes. People tend to give up on them. And in fact, if that was an incorrect diagnosis, you've really allotted that person a certain fate that maybe they didn't necessarily deserve. So you're right. It's a good point that you bring up. It is a rare occurrence, and most patients who are in that state probably won't have the sort of survival. But what is it that allowed him to survive? And what can we all learn from it? As opposed to just assigning it the quality of miracle or outlier, let's dissect it, figure it out, and use some of those same principles for other patients.
All of these cases, and in particular a case you write about fetal surgery on a fetus to repair a defect in the heart that was going to continue after birth, raise such complicated moral and ethical questions about what should be done, when should it be done, how do we look at life and death. As a doctor, how do you approach these questions?
Well, you know, I think that we don't really know what dead is. And I think that that will surprise a lot of people who just heard me say that. But if you go around and ask, you know, people who specialize in this area, have been doing decades of research on death itself, we don't really know what it is. And maybe we should have a better understanding of it in 2009 than we do. Some could make that argument. But I think that the way I approach it is I look at these as opportunities to intervene and possibly do something. And keep in mind, I think it's worth making the point again, especially in this era of lots of discussion about healthcare reform, that when it comes to cardiac compressions, I'm talking about using your two hands and some of the muscles in your biceps. I'm not talking about using billion-dollar drugs. And the same thing is true of hypothermia. These are relatively inexpensive or free therapies that can make a huge difference. I think that, you know, until we know what dead really is, there are always going to be opportunities to try and intervene on life's behalf. My attitudes toward this have changed. I first thought about this when I was a medical student. Now I'm a father of three children. You know, I'm married. I think about things differently than I think I thought before. And one of them is that would I know what to do? Would I know when to give up? Would I know how to make the right decisions? And I got to thinking, I'm a neurosurgeon. You know, I'm a highly trained physician, and I don't know the answers to all those questions. So the discussion is worth having. Let's have it, and maybe it'll make a difference in people's lives.
And it is one, having just gone through the anguish of having a loved one dying, yet there were interventions we could have done, but his quality of life would have been terrible. Making those decisions in the moment is very anguishing. It's very harrowing. And so it is having the discussion when we can sit here across the table, maybe an easy way to begin that conversation.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I don't. The intent of this book is not to make the discussions even harder to have and not to try and provide hope where there is none. But I think that there are opportunities still where maybe you know, if they feel like they haven't not ready to give up yet, there are stories of how people survive when the odds were very much against them. This could provide some hope for them, and I think that, you know, I think about that all the time.
Some, though, like this tiny baby who had prenatal surgery and then was born to have to go through a number of other surgeries. As a mother, I just looked at that and thought, oh my gosh, how anguishing to see your child have to go through so much just to be able to sit in a high chair. And as you write, the joy of watching him eat food for the first time. How do these very amazing new ways of intervening affect everyday life for people?
Well, you know, I think it ends up being a very personal decision for a lot of people. And everyone that's probably reading the book or thinking about this will probably approach things differently than maybe even their neighbor or even people within their own family. For this baby that you're talking about, this at the time an unborn child who had a fatal heart defect, That this was a family that decided that they would do anything at all to try and preserve this child's life. Now, they weren't unrealistic. I mean, the mother was an obstetrician. She knows this better than most. And yet she realized, based on what she had read and what she had seen, that there was a real shot at not only saving her unborn baby, but also giving the child a real sense, a chance at a normal life. And she wanted to do it. So the reason I talked about him, Anders, was because this is the opposite end. You know, we talk a lot about sort of saving people near the end of their lives, as young as they may be. This was before they were even born. And how are we pushing the boundaries of life in at the beginning as well as at the end? You know, again, it provokes a lot of discussion. Every time it seems I get on a train or in a crowd of people, these topics come up with people since I've written the book. But again, I think these are discussions worth having in the medical profession as well as doctors with their patients.
These stories aren't in the book, but did you encounter anyone who regretted having pushed so hard to try to extend life?
You know, there were stories of people who in the end, their efforts did not bear fruit, so to speak. They did not live a longer life as a result of everything they did. And their family members who I interviewed, you know, I talked to them about that. I don't think regret would be the right word. In fact, I think there's a sense of peace almost for families and loved ones who feel like they left no stone unturned. They realize that in the end, they did everything that they thought they could to try, if they thought it was the right thing, to preserve the person's life and their quality of life. If it didn't work out, and somehow it was a sense of almost peace for the loved ones who were left behind.
In addition to this book, you have put together a documentary about this work. How do they differ, or are they very much the same?
I think they differ to some degree. You know, obviously, you know, a book is very different than a television program, and I think maybe that's obvious to say, but when you're trying to create a documentary, I think your focus does have to be different than a book. A book is much more of a narrative.
Well, you can't do a documentary wandering around your house thinking.
Yeah,
I guess you can think about it, but it's very different
than
the writing process.
Yeah, and it's very hard, I find, to go back and forth, because I've done this before where I have documentaries in association with books. But I think that what I find is that health and medical type books, science books like this, have a real need in some ways to actually allow you to meet these people, to, you know, almost get the flesh and blood, see what their lives are like. What are their parents like? What do they think about all this? You know, that whole thing, some of the questions you were just asking me, Anders, his mother, what was she thinking during all this? Well, you can watch a documentary and see some of that. So I also wanted to test some of these scientific principles myself. So actually go into a suspended animation lab and see with my own eyes how this works. Hypothermia, to go to Norway, to actually meet Anna Bagenholm, to get in some of this water and see what that really is like, what happens during hypothermia. So these are the real stories of survival, and also the doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals who made them happen.
And so this, in a sense, is a companion, but it's not a word-for-word transcription of what you wrote in your book.
No, it's not. But I you know, it's sort of the most sort of thriller-esque documentary that I put together, because the stories sort of really have a cadence of their own. And I, even as I was watching it again last night, sort of, you know, you get kind of exhilarated sort of trying to figure out what's the next step, what's going to happen next.
How do you balance in your own life all of these different pursuits? You are a neurosurgeon. You work as a doctor. You report on various things. You were just in Afghanistan, and you write books. How do you balance all of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I was a writer for a while before I really became a neurosurgeon. I used to write for various magazines. I worked at the White House as a writer, you know, for some time. And so that was sort of a first love. And I think that sort of transitioned a bit into, you know, a lot of it was health related. So doing health, you know, sort of reporting in some ways was a logical transition, although it didn't make a lot of sense, frankly, at the time. I sort of have always been a doctor first, and I'm still a doctor first. I still sort of consider journalism sort of the side career, although it takes up more time than it ever has before. But I don't see them as disparate things. You know, I take care of patients in the hospital, but I get to inform and create knowledge for potential patients in what I do. The only bad thing is that, you know, you take time off from one job to go shoot a documentary or something. It's like vacation from your other job.
So well, I was going to say, the thing I left out was, and you're a father with three children.
Yeah.
Too.
And that's hard. You know, I mean, there's no bones about it. It is hard. I would be lying if I said it was perfect. I wish I spent more time at home and spent more time with my kids. And, you know, it's you sort of fall into the trap as you get older, because you always say, I'm not going to be that person who wasn't around enough. And then a few weeks go by and you're like, wait a second, I'm sort of becoming that person. So, you know, I mean, I don't live in the world of guilt. I try and spend really quality time with whatever I do. And I also am very good about compartmentalizing. So when I'm at the hospital, I'm at the hospital. When I'm working on a documentary, I'm doing that. When I'm with my kids, I do that. And that's, they know it, and they're great about it.
It does sound like the writing and the exploration that you do there comes right back to the work that you do as a neurosurgeon also.
Yeah, it's you can compartmentalize, but there is a lot of transitions. You know, I mean, I've been interested in this topic about death since I was a medical student, like I mentioned. And here now I have these amazing resources and opportunities to really go and figure it out myself, talk to the best scientists, travel all over the world, and learn, and then think about it for a couple of years before I really start putting pen to paper, which was great.
Well, I'm speaking with Dr. Sanjay Gupta about his new book, Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Great show. Thank you.
It's published by Grand Central Press. Dr. Sanjay Gupta will be speaking with Dr. Gail Saltz tonight at 8 p.m. at the 92nd Street Y. For more information, visit our show page.